Good evening. It's Tuesday evening, May 20th. As our television share, tonight's share is sponsored by Susie and Lenny Presby to commemorate the art site of Susie's father, Yitzhak Isaac Ben Mordechai, and also to celebrate the birth of their grandchild, Mayan Gila.
Which grandchild is that?
No.
Okay, thank you. The topic we have on the agenda for tonight is, it'll probably take us more than one session, we'll see how it goes. It's probably one of the most controversial topics out there. Its very essence is controversy. It's controversial every step of the way, every detail, every aspect. It was born in controversy, it continues to exist in controversy, it's controversy that's known to the readers of the New York Times as well as to the readers of the Jewish Press, to the readers of the Jordan Times, and the readers of many different realms. It's really a very controversial topic on every different level. And I would just like to give a little bit of an overview of some of the issues, some of the questions, and some of the different levels on which you could try to understand. And hopefully we can come to understand both sides of the equation maybe a little bit better than we have. There's the topic of the Hetzer Mechira, which is doubly relevant to us right now, because one, it's a Shemitah year right now, which we assume, and we're coming off of Parshas Bahar. So we've been meaning to get to this topic for a while. I thought that especially now when we just read about Shemitah in this past week's class, so that maybe we would take this opportunity to look at the topic a little bit. Roughly 120 years ago or so, a little more, the situation in the land of Israel was very dire. Actually, not much has changed, and that's actually part of the question. To what extent has things changed or have not things changed? But certainly for its own reasons, the situation was dire then. In addition to other things, a lot of the issue was economic. You didn't have a government, you didn't have a state of Israel, you didn't have millions of Jews living there, you had a few settlements, you had a few brave Jews trying to hold up the fort, and the notion of taking off a year for Shemitah is very, very daunting. From a perspective of simple survival, the idea that they would be able to continue to support themselves if they took off a year of planting was very hard to come to grips with that idea. So there was a proposal, which later came to be known as the Hetzer Mechira, that was mostly suggested by European Rabbanim. Shmuel Maliver, famous for his achievements in religious Zionism, was involved in this. Shmuel Zainville Klapfish and Shula Mikutno, Shua Trunk Mikutno, is a very, very prominent Talmud Chacham, the author of the Tshuvas Yeshuas Malcho and other things, were among the supporters of this proposal. And it was signed off on, it was approved by, it was known as the Gadol Hador at that time, the namesake of our yeshiva, the Bissek Elchanan Spector. Yeshiva University, this yeshiva is named after him, at the Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. So Bissek Elchanan approved the Hetzer, and the hope was that this would gain wide acceptance, and that was not the case. It became a very big fight, and every aspect of it became a fight. Even the question of Rabbi Hanan's endorsement became a fight. There were those who said that he was misled, that he endorsed the plan based on an inaccurate picture of just how dire things were. He was presented a picture of Pikuach Nefesh, essentially, and maybe that was not the case. That's how some maintain. But Blazer Gordon of Tells has in his letters that he thought it was inappropriate for Bissek Elchanan to endorse such a thing because here this is such a earth-shattering global topic that all the Talmidei Chachamim and Klal Yisrael would have to get together and endorse this. And lacking that, it wasn't right. And Rosh Hashanah points out, you could say the same, that all the Chachamim should have to oppose it also. To say that one direction is inappropriate any more than the other is not necessarily so convincing. But that was what he wrote. And again, so it was controversial from the very beginning. And it's written that Rabbi Chanan was taken aback. He wasn't expecting such a backlash. And he was also very saddened by how things were received. Rav Kook is a name that's very often associated with the Hetzer. Rav Kook clearly did not invent the Hetzer. It predated him. So it predated his position within the land of Israel. He was living in Europe before that. And when he lived in Europe, he records that both he and his father-in-law, who was known as the Adaris, who was from Dov Rabinowitz Tumim, the Rashi Tavis, Aleph Salad, Reish Tuf, so both of them were opposed. They didn't think it sounded to them like a good idea. And then when they came to Eretz Yisrael and they saw the situation, then they changed their minds. And Rav Kook became a major advocate, and he wrote a sefer called Shabbos Haaretz. It's a phrase from his past week's parsha, a reference to Shemitah. And most of Shabbos Haaretz is about the Hetzer Mechira, and many of the tshuvas and his printed tshuvas are about this as well. And again, he didn't invent it, but he supplied a lot of the support for it, a lot of the explanation, and a lot of the substance to what would later be discussed was provided by Rav Kook's tshuvas. Also, again, earlier Rav Shulam Kutna and his tshuvas, Yeshua Salko, has a number of tshuvas which are very important and very often cited as far as this topic is concerned. But Rav Kook also writes in his letters that he didn't reveal everything, that he didn't express all of his reasons for supporting the Hetzer, because he wanted that this should be a little bit mysterious. He didn't want that this should be so accepted, because he also acknowledged that this isn't really the ideal, that this is hopefully going to be a temporary measure, this is a stopgap until we get to a different stage, and therefore he didn't want this to become the default position. He didn't want this to become the established reality. So that's part of what creates a lot of the debate, that this ambivalence is already there in the writings of the supporters, already there in Rav Kook's writings and the writings of many others. And the question to which it was ever meant to continue as long as it did, as long as it has, as long as it's still going on, is a topic of great debate. And therefore, part of the issue is that even those who have nothing but the highest respect for those who supported it 100 years ago or 80 years ago are not sure what the story would be today. Rav Kook was writing before there was a state. Certainly very significant differences have taken place in history since Rav Kook passed away in 1935. And therefore, there's a lot of debate to what extent the original supporters would continue to support it, which is not to say they wouldn't. You can make a good argument that they would, and you can make a good argument that they wouldn't. It just leaves extra room to fight about, other extra room to have a controversy. And especially because it is in these writings, almost across the board, it's Gochanan and Rav Kook and others, that this shouldn't be a permanent move, that this is something that needs to be constantly reevaluated, and therefore, again, that leaves always room for argument. So then every cycle, we can come back and look at the question again. Is this where we're holding? Is this what needs to be done? And it leaves open the issue, no matter what's been written in the past. It always leaves that variable there that can always be argued, no matter what the weight of opinions is as far as the writings of history. So just a broad sense why this starts off so controversial. So some of the bases, and we'll just mention first before getting into the specific issues, so some of the premises for undertaking such a maneuver, by the way, I haven't explained it all yet. I assume we basically understand the basic one sentence summary, that the idea is that the land is sold on some level to non-Jewish hands, and the assumption is that that takes away, at least on some level, the prohibitions of Shemitah, and we'll go into more detail about that. But that plan, many thought, Reb Shulam Kutna among them, that it shouldn't be perceived any differently than Mechiras Chametz, which I think we spoke about before Pesach. A few weeks ago we spoke about Mechiras Chametz. So Mechiras Chametz, also controversial somewhat, but not nearly as controversial, certainly not nowadays. Nowadays it's much more widely accepted. So if those if people are able to live with Mechiras Chametz, so there are those who felt that the same logic should apply equally to Hetzer Mechira. Hi.
Could you pure stuff is still coming to Siddur Reis, so there's no question.
Mm-hmm.
The Shemitah nowadays is Siddur Reis.
So that sounds like a Kal v'chomer in the other way.
Yeah.
Right, so that's part of, so we'll get to that. We'll get to some of the differences now, but as I'll also get to it, I don't know if we'll get to it tonight or next time, but there's a lot of unclarity also, even about Rav Soloveitchik's opinion, not going back so many decades, but even about Rav Soloveitchik's opinion, I had to personally research and find a lot of frustration as far as clarifying what his opinion was. But one person did write, which is different than a lot of the other things that's in his name, that he asked the Rav before going to Eretz Yisrael, I don't know, maybe in the 70s or the early 60s, should he rely on Hetz Mechira? And he relates that the Rav said to him, "You sell your chametz?" And he said, "Yes." He says, "Well, if you rely on it for the biblical prohibition of chametz, if you act like you're saying, then you should rely on it here as well." So that reflects the attitude that I'm sure McClinton and others were. That could be also right. So he's not necessarily endorsing selling the chametz. He's saying, if you will see pascha, you think you can sell your chametz, then you can sell this as well. Now, even that sentence is what to argue about. we'll get to it.
Wasn't supposed to be that they had complete control of the land before Shemitah became effective?
Oh, so then we'll get to that also. So there's some of the general points. Let's just mention some of the general points before getting to the specifics, some of the general arguments that are thrown around there. So on the one hand, those who opposed the Hetz Mechira, again, maybe just talking in general terms right now, will say, listen, read last week's parsha. You see, the idea that Shemitah can be hard is not a chiddush. You know, we know that it's going to be hard. We know that it's a challenge. And Kadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm going to take care of you. So that's what it is. You know, we're not here to get around it. And Rishul Mikutno and others wrote that, no, that only applies when we're in full-fledged Shemitah Daraisa, everything is in its place. So right now, as they all agreed, we're in this crisis mode, so to speak. We're in the trying to make it from one stage to the other, and the hope of that is why we're motivated to do this. And we don't assume that the bracha is in effect yet. That's how he assumed that the bracha would only be in effect when Shemitah is an obligation in HaTorah, which we haven't even explained that part yet, and when everything is in place and all of that, then this concept is going to be relevant. So as far as Mechiras Chametz comparison is concerned, so there are those who felt comfortable with that, and there are those who felt it's very lopsided comparison. Even if you assume that Mechiras Chametz is not controversial, let's face that, we talked about a few weeks ago, let's say you accept Mechiras Chametz as a concept. So there are those who felt that there were many very significant differences. And just to mention a few of them, one very practical difference is that presumably, if the non-Jewish individual purchases your chametz, should show up on Pesach and say, listen, I'm interested in keeping the chametz, I'm going to write you out a check for the full value that I still owe you, so here you are, the value of the chametz, I'm taking it and I'm going to take it home. So you'd probably be okay with that. You'd probably also accept that. That was all a financially motivated point to begin with. And therefore, if that's what you're willing to do, fine, great. Now we know if we transfer that over to Shemitah, sorry, not great. You can't imagine that if the Arab comes and says, listen, I'll write you out a check and I'm going to take over your lands forever, or more than that, and you're certainly not going to be okay with it. So that's a very big factor that differentiates the two. In addition, usually when you sell your chametz, so you don't have any involvement with it during that period of time. There's some exceptions which are controversial. For the most part, that's certainly the ideal. You're not involved with the chametz during the time of Pesach. And here, that's not necessarily the case. Here, this is the land will continue to be worked. That's really why you're doing it. So that, again, is a very significant difference. In addition, there's a plausibility factor. You know, the idea that Mr. Brown is purchasing all your chametz, you could believe that. The idea that one Arab is buying the whole land of Israel, it's very hard to swallow that as a plausible concept. And also very pointedly, some point out that when it comes to Mechiras Chametz, and here this is where there's also a big philosophical difference as well, when it comes to Mechiras Chametz, this is a way of fulfilling what the Torah is asking. The Torah says, get rid of the Chametz. So I get rid of the Chametz by destroying it, or I get rid of it by selling it to somebody else. Either way, I'm selling it, I believe that's the way of getting rid of it. But when it comes to here, when it comes to Shemitah, so the Torah says, don't work the land, and you're selling it so that you can work the land. So it becomes a controversial topic. I think we mentioned when we discussed the chametz, you know, the joke they tell that the rabbis came out and prohibited smoking, but the Orthodox Jews are not concerned, they're just going to sell their lungs to a non-Jew. That's the idea that selling your property is a way of getting around the prohibition. So that's the concern here. So when it comes to selling chametz, so it's not necessarily a way of, it's a way of dealing with the post-Pesach issues. You don't want to have to buy new chametz, so then you take care of it now. You don't want to lose your money. But basically, the goal of Pesach, you're accomplishing keeping your chametz away from you on some level. And so it's a bezdin, Osir bezdin, is he referring to? Osir bezdin don't actually sell it to bezdin. We'll have to maybe get to that a little bit as one of the alternatives. There's a whole other complicated structure. There's another avenue which is considered, it depends who you ask, and then everyone agrees, but there are those who believe that Osir bezdin certainly culturally seems to be preferred, but whether it's based on sound halachic reasoning is a question, but there's another mechanism very, very quickly which involves declaring all the land hefker ownerless and letting Bezdin manage the sale of the fruits, just the fruits, which is not selling it to Bezdin, but letting Bezdin handle how it's done. So there are reasons why it may be better, reasons why it may be less good, and interesting comparisons you find in the farm. And we'll try to come to that maybe at the end. So that's part of the issue, whether this whole comparison to Mechiras Chametz is reasonable is a topic of some debate. On the other hand, some of the premises that make this work and make this valid, so first and foremost, is the presumption that Shemitah nowadays is midrabanan. And that's the overwhelming assumption. Not everyone agrees with this. There are those, even our Hayom Hazad, there are Migdali HaChronim, and Nitziv among them, and others. Nitziv was a big opponent of the Hetzer Mechira, that Nitziv was with Cook's Rabbi, which is also interesting, that who held that the Shemitah is the Raisa. And there were others, Rosh Shterbach in his Sefer, he apparently feels that he has to argue on every single prat of the Hetzer Mechira, any step that could have possibly lead to the Hetzer Mechira being accepted, he has to argue on. So, according to him, Shemitah Tereis, every detail, anything that could possibly be a building block in allowing it, he argues on. He certainly argues on that. But it seems to be the majority of Achronim take the view that Shemitah nowadays is Drabbanim. Why should Shemitah be Drabbanim nowadays? So there are two different types of reasons. And it makes a difference which reason you believe in. One reason is that all of the halachas of Kedusha Sa'aretz might be the Rabbanan nowadays, and maybe the whole sanctity of the land is taken to be the Rabbanan, and therefore everything that has to do with Eretz Yisrael halachically as far as Trumas, Meisers, and the like, that's all the Rabbanan. The other possibility is more specific to Shemitah, that it could be that Shemitah is tied into Yovel, as we saw from the Parsha. Yovel, we assume, is only relevant when Rov Yosheva Ha'olah, when most of the Jewish population is living in Israel, which could happen pretty soon. Demographically, we just hit the point where more Jews live in Israel than any other one place, there's a plurality. So the point where it's supposed to hit a majority is not so far off demographically predicted. So it could be that might shift, and that'd be interesting what that does to things if that's the case. But that's also a possibility that nowadays, if Yovel is Rabbanim, then Shemitah is also the Rabbanim. And that would be a reason more specific to Shemitah rather than something that's reflective of all the agricultural halachas as a whole. Now there are those who say even more than that. There is the view that Shemitah nowadays is not even the Rabbanim, but that it is amidus chasidus, that it's not really an obligation at all, that Chazal did not institute any observance of Shemitah on any real level, and it's voluntary. So if that's the case, so then it certainly gives more grounds to be lenient. But also, even if you don't accept that opinion, so there is also a view that when it's a shashat chak, when it's a very pressing need, as it has and others point out, so you can rely on a minority opinion, even though you wouldn't normally paskin based on a minority view, but if it's a situation of a shashat chak, so sometimes we rely on a minority view. So basically it's three points that are all either taken by themselves, taken together, that either you believe that it's only a midas chasidus, or you believe that you don't really believe that, but you believe the shashat chak, you have the right to take a minority view, or it's the shashat chak itself. So those three elements, I think. So primarily the Raza, primarily the Balamar, Zerachya Halevi. Now, some point out, some argue on both fronts. Some argue that it's not even a Yidat Yafir, both directions. I mean, some argue it's not even a Das Yachid, either because he's totally rejected, the view is so completely overtaken, overwhelmed, that it doesn't even count as an opinion anymore. Or another view of that is that he didn't mean that, that maybe he was only referring to Shemitah's Kesafim, that maybe the idea that we cancel loans is the Rabbanan, but Shemitah itself, Amari is Minas Chasidus, but Shemitah itself is at least within the Rabbanan. So you have those who argue on that end that it's not even a Das Yachid. And on the other end, the Bavadi Yosef and the Rav Zevin, who has an essay about this, both feel that they dug up a few other opinions who hold like this also. So it's not only a Das Yachid, that there's a small minority view, but it's not a lone opinion. It's an opinion of a significant minority, not just of one. Well, hasn't the Rambam translated the idea that the Kedusha was never meant to be permanent, the Kedusha of Ezra was never meant to be permanent, because the knowledge was that there was going to be another Kedusha afterwards that was going to overtake it, so therefore with the Gullish it didn't continue to permeate, so once we were kicked out, so then we didn't, how that exactly affects things is a little bit complicated, we'll come back to that more, but there's various reasons for taking that route, but just this idea that Kedushas Haaretz as a whole might be the Rabbanan, it's an idea that a number of Rishonim hold, and we'll come back and talk about it in more detail.
If it's the Reisa, then would the Shemitah be the Reisa?
Not necessarily, because you could divide. You could say that Kedushas Haaretz is the Reisa, and still say that Shemitah itself is dependent on Yovel, and Yovel might be the Rabbanan as well at best. So essentially, those factors, again, these questions, you can take any one of them by themselves, you can combine them. So there's Shemitah Rabbanan, there's Shasha Tchak, and Das Yachid, etc., that whole mix. And the Shasha Tchak, of course, is the motivation for the whole thing, and the question is how much that is the operative factor. There are a few other elements also. There is a Gemara Mesechus Sanhedrin, which talks about a tax that was called the Arnuna. And the Gemara there says in Daf Chavav that this tax allowed them to suspend certain Shemitah restrictions. So there's a lot of comments in the Rishonim as to what that is, what was going on there. Is it because Shemitah's Rabbanan? That was Tosus's view and one of the opinions in Tosus. And therefore, again, if you say Shemitah's Rabbanan, apparently we're more ready to allow apparently economic concerns to overwhelm the prohibitions of Shemitah. Or is it that it was bordering on Fikuach Nefesh? It's also an opinion on Tosus. And again, maybe that's still applicable here. So the extent to which that sugya of Arnuna is a good model is debated, but that's also part of what's thrown into the mix. And another element that's also thrown into the mix, and that is the question of whether it really is Shemitah or not. That there's a machlokas in the Rishonim, the Rambam, and the Gaonim as to how to count the whole Shemitah cycle, whether you count the Yovel as an extra year or not. So it actually comes out that we're not 1,000% sure that, let's say this year, is there Shemitah year? It could be that there's actually a 3-year range in which Shemitah could be. So there were those who said that, okay, so we could put that in the mix also, that essentially it's a suffix on top of everything else, whether it's even Shemitah. So it's a suffix of a Derabbanan or a Mishkatir, or a Shasachat, throw that all in and say that it's a suffix. The Beis Halevi, who is also a very strong opponent of the Hatter, he very much doesn't like that type of thinking. He says to say that it's a suffix Shemitah, he says you can't work like that. He says that the idea of suffix Rabbanan Lakula, as we mentioned in the context of Dalet Tosos, the idea that we could be lenient when it comes to rabbinical law, so we never apply that negate a halacha to say, well, if we're not sure if it goes here or there, so we assume it goes nowhere. We can't ever say like that. And if anything, you have to go in the other direction, that even if it's Rabbanan, you would have to say, if I'm not sure if it's A or B, and there's no reason to distinguish between A or B, then I'm going to have to assume it's A and B. So basically, the basic lady says, if you want to follow this line of reasoning, you have to say that all the years are Shemitah. So I advise you to avoid that, as these days say, I advise you to avoid that type of thinking. Trust us, this year is Shemitah, and don't start introducing Shafik into it, because it's going to get even more complicated. You're going to regret following that path. So essentially, those are some of the broader issues as far as general factors that go into either accepting it or not accepting it. And before getting into some of the more specific issues, just to mention also some of the conditions that those who endorsed the Hetter had put in. So there were a number of conditions that they actually insisted upon, although maybe it's just wrong term, as we'll see. Partially it was that the land, the type of work being done on the land, first of all, should only be the Rabbanans, not the Raisas. And we talk about Shemitah. There's a lot of overlap between Shemitah and Shabbos, not only in the other concepts, the seven-part cycle and Shabbos Haaretz language, but also the concept of Malachas. We talk about Malachas the Reis, Malachas the Rabbanan, we talk about that in Shabbos, and we talk about it in Shemitah also. There's certain Malachas that are very fundamental, and those are Malachas the Reis, and then there are other acts that we do that are not as fundamental. So some of the endorsers of the Hetzer insisted that it should only be Malachas the Rabbanan that are done. Which is a little bit of a question why that should be. If you're working off the premise that everything is Rabbanan, then why should we distinguish between what types of halachas are being done? So that's a question. It may go to the idea, and we'll discuss this more, that maybe there's two different levels here, that maybe we could believe that the selling of the land allows the produce to be used, but doesn't necessarily allow actual work on the land, which is how some Rishonim help. So maybe they were... So actual work on the land, which is more the Malacha Dereisha type, is the even greater hesitancy to allow that. Another factor was that the work should not be done by Jews, it should be done by non-Jews on behalf of the Jews. That's very questionable to what extent that's being adhered to. And the Chazon Ish, in his objections, he writes in one of his letters that this is part of his problem. This is about claim that it's all going to be done by non-Jews. But then it's going to end up being done by Jews. We'll say, what can we do? We have no other way. And that's going to happen. It's not going to work. That whole distinction. Indeed, it's questionable to what extent it ever did work. These poskim did right. Shasha Tzach, it could be a Jew if you can't find anybody else. But that was also part of the condition. To what extent it's been followed is somewhat open to question. Other factors included that it should just be upkeep and not increasing the crops. Just make sure things stay at the same level. And again, this factor of constant review, and it should always be looked at again, and always be considered. That was also, again, conditions that were brought in. Okay, so now to get to some of the specifics, we'll see how far we get tonight, but essentially objections to the Hetzer could break down into a couple of categories. One category is, does it work? Simply, do the details fit? Second category is, if it works, is it still permissible? Maybe it could work, but it's not permissible to do. Third category could be combining the two. It might be ineffectual because of some prohibition. And then there are broader philosophical issues. So we could look at those in four categories. So the first category, does it work? Simply, what's this premised on? So the truth is, the whole basis for this whole plan is a debate the Gemara has in a couple places, mostly in the context of other aspects of Kedushas Haaretz, Trumas and Nisus and the like. It's a debate in the Gemara whether or not we say that the shorthand is Yesh Kinyan Lahafkia. The longer sentence is Yesh Kinyan Leiber Kochavim Lahafkia Me Kedushas Haaretz, something like that. To say that there is acquisition, there is a Kinyan for a non-Jew to remove the land from its holiness. In other words, if I would sell the land to somebody who's not Jewish, or do we say, okay, it's no longer Eretz Yisrael in the sense of Kedusha. It no longer has the holiness of Eretz Yisrael. Whatever holiness was creating, whatever halachos, has now left because it transferred ownership. So there's a debate a couple of places with the Gemara in Gittin, and the Gemara elsewhere. It comes up in a couple of places. And it would seem like this is the crucial make or break issue, that if you can't get past this issue, then we're in trouble. But this seems to be the basic premise that selling land makes a difference. If selling land doesn't make a difference, if you come down the chumra on this issue, then you seem to have nowhere to go. Now the truth is, it seems like most Rishonim do come out the chumra on this issue, and assume that the conclusion is that ain kinyan lahafkia. So let's close up shop right now, so the whole discussion is over. So how do we get past this? So the key point is that the assumption seems to be that that's true when the Kedusha is Dereisha. So if the Kedusha is Mana Torah, so then selling it wouldn't make a difference. But when the Kedusha is Derabanan, so then, again, that it seems to be the key factor here. So that's why another reason why this is really a fundamental, essential point of the whole debate, to assume that Shemitah is Derabanan. Now, the Beis HaLevi part of his objection. He said, now hold on a second, well, it depends. You know, keep in mind that there are different reasons why something, why there may not be any Kedusha. If you want to say that the whole Eretz Yisrael is only Kedusha Derabbanan, so then I could believe that maybe then that selling it to a non-Jew takes away its Kedusha. But if you believe that the Kedusha is Deraisha, the Shemitah is Derabbanan, so then who says that selling it should make a difference? Who says that should cancel out anything? That was part of, again, his objection to the whole story. He didn't feel that was... In fact, the Rebbe Ganek has an essay about this in his Shvei for Ganes Hashanim, but that detail in the Beis Halevi, there's a lot of lumbus to figure out over there about the two different reasons why the Kedusha might be Rabbana and how that might affect this whole story. So, then let's work off that premise. Okay, so let's say, so that maybe if the Kedusha is Rabbana, so then do we say Yesh Kenil Haskiyah? So here, working off that premise, you have much more solid support, even though it's still controversial. And this is basically known as a debate between the Beis Yosef, so a pretty heavy gun, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, and his contemporary, the Mavit, and his son, the Marit. They both argued on the Beis Yosef that the Beis Yosef felt that the Peiros Haaretz, if they were sold to a non-Jew, didn't have Kedusha. And this is a lengthy discussion about who's right on this point. Again, Beis Yosef's a pretty significant voice here, but who wins in this debate is still a big topic of contention. Now, you clearly need the Beis Yosef in order to function here. We need to work off the Beis Yosef's view in order for this plan to work, but it doesn't necessarily go the other direction. You can support the Beis Yosef without supporting the Hetzer Mechira for a number of reasons. Because, first of all, the Beis Yosef is talking about where it happens to be that this was sold, not saying that you should sell in order to get out of Shemitah. And that's one reason. Another reason is, as we alluded to before, that he may only be talking about the produce. He's not necessarily talking about the land. That's also a topic of some debate. He, for one, interprets the Rambam, by the way, and his point, because the Rambam says that if you sell land to a non-Jew, then it remains in its Kedusha. So it sounds like that doesn't help us. Right? It sounds like it stays the way it is. So the Yosef understood by Rambam to mean that if you sell land to a non-Jew and then you buy it back, the Kedusha returns. But when it's in his hands, then the Kedusha isn't there. So he feels that that's his view. And again, you don't have to go all the way to Hetzer Mechira for this from this point of view. And part of the proof of that is, again, it's a big debate whether the Beis Yosef of the Mabit is right. There are some who maintain the Beis Yosef changed his mind in the end of his life, and there are those who argue on that, a lot of literature about this. Sorry?
I'm going to go back to this point. Where did we learn that a Jew could even sell land?
We don't know that yet. That we haven't got to that yet. Yeah, first we just want to know if it would work. That's step one. So we have to, our categories before were first, does it work? Second, is it mutter? So first we have to know if it works. So, whether or not the Beis Yosef reached the Hetzer Mechira, it's very much not an equal equation, because on this debate, while it's still an open question, who's right, the Beis Yosef or the Mabit, certainly there is a lot of weight behind the Beis Yosef, besides his own personal stature, but those who paskin like him, and certainly the population of those who paskin like the Beis Yosef is very not equal to the population that supports the Hetzer Mechira. To give you one example, there was a sefer that came out not long ago, within the past 20 years, an anonymous sefer, I think it was called Minchas Emes, something like that, where he basically, the whole sefer was devoted to destroying the Beis Yosef at this point, saying that the Mabit is right, and then that's the way it's always been, and Mabit is king here, and the Beis Yosef is wrong. So another sefer came out after that, I think called Minchas Ha'ares, also anonymous, defending the Beis Yosef, and the Beis Yosef is right, and that's the way it's always been, and he has a couple hundred pages defending the Beis Yosef. So if you look at the Haskamas in the front of that sefer, so you see the Haskamas of some people, you know, supporting again this monograph on behalf of the Beis Yosef, the Haskamas are from people who do not necessarily support the Hetzer Mechira at all, including this letter there from Rav Moshe Aryeh Fine, who writes, this is a wonderful sefer, and learning the sefer should be a tremendous chus for all of us, and help the situation of Shemitah, so that none of us should have to rely chas v'shalom on Hetzer Mechira. So it's very clear that he does not support the Hetzer Mechira, and he's enthusiastically supporting this book, which advocates the Beis Yosef's position, which just illustrates that you can agree with the Beis Yosef and not go so far as to get to have the Mechir. So that's one of the questions. So one of the questions is simply, is the premise true? And if you say that selling the land is what the plan is based on, so does that make a difference? Does it work? That's step one. So you have pretty solid grounds to believe that it does. Again, the Beis Yosef and many of the Gedolei Achronim who Paskin like him, with some question as to what was the scope of the Beis Yosef's fact. It's also a topic of some additional controversy. Shlomo Zalman Orbach's sefer that he wrote in his youth about Shemitah called Ma'adoni Aretz. So a lot of it was about supporting some of the basis use of the Hatzim Mechira, and unfortunately a lot of that's been edited out of the later versions. It's a whole controversy in itself. And a lot of the earlier pieces, he explains the different angles towards the Beis Yosef and the Mabit, etc. So, in any event, that's one of the reasons why it may or may not work. Another reason why it may or may not work is really separate from that. Just the question of, is the sale effective? So that goes to two different types of problems. One problem is what we'll call miras das, or smichas das. That is, does anybody really believe in what they're doing? Are they selling the land with any real intent that it should be sold? And a related problem, which is different but connected, is the problem of dina de malchus de dina. Does the sale conform with the legalities involved? And one of the common issues between the two is that if you ever buy land in Eretz Yisrael, so there is a registry called the Tabu, which dates back to the Turkish government, and the rule is that all land sales have to be registered in the Tabu. So if you're doing a sale here which is not registered, so that's on both these fronts, that's a problem. So then, first of all, the people believe that it's a real sale, if they know that this is what they normally have to do and they're not doing that. And also, is it legal? And if it's not legal, then does it work? What about, you know, the Mochus or Dina? So, first of all, to the broader question of Miras Das, so here again you have arguments on both sides. You have those who say that they're very hesitant to believe that it's a real sale because, first of all, it has the legal fiction component to it that undermines its reality in people's minds. And that a lot of the people who are doing it, they're not religious, they're not knowledgeable, or being told this is what they're meant to do, and they're not going to perceive it as any real sale to begin with. And that's a question. Ruf Cook, for his part, felt that that made it better. That the fact that it's, you know, the problem is its own solution. The fact that this is a religious technique, so to speak, so that helps, because if it was a real sale, so then the people wouldn't want to go ahead with it. They'd be afraid if they thought that it was a sale for its real purpose, so then they would really insist on it following all the rules. But because they know that it's only to accomplish a religious goal, so then they are fully committed to that extent, and therefore it is genuine. You know, so you could see it both ways. You could come to that point from both directions. Hi.
No, I have another question, which is, after Hashem gives us the land, right?
The prohibition. Right.
And, you know, you can now.
We don't know that. We're not up to that yet. We're still in sphere one of the work. Yeah, it's a big question, and we'll get up to it. We'll probably at this point next time, but we'll get to it.
Could you sell just the yield of the land for 1 year?
So maybe yes, maybe no. The question is, what does that accomplish? And also, you won't be able to work the land. And if that's the whole...
And
selling the yield of the land has its own problems, because that you're supposed to be mafkir. In theory, there are certain distinctions in what you're selling and what you're not selling, but that opens up a whole other realm of problems. So this question of, first of all, does it conform, and forget the law for a second, does it conform to expectations, does it conform to what people believe is true? So that's one problem. There's a very important authority on this point, who we'll refer to probably a number of times, and if you're familiar with his name, Zev Whitman, Whitman, is that a familiar name? He's a very chashuv person in this debate. He's maybe more often known as the Rav of Tnuva. Tnuva is a huge dairy company in Israel, and he's their postrek. And he also is the official, on behalf of the chief rabbinate, in charge of Shemitah. So he's a very, he has a lot of very fascinating writings on this topic, because he's the one performing the Hatzimakira. He's in charge of it. He's working for the chief rabbinate. He himself is not at all a supporter of the Hatzimakira. He has a lot of serious objections to it from a philosophical point of view, to a from a halachic point of view. He's written extensively on this. So it's a good situation in that sense, because I mean, the person who's doing it is really trying to do everything the best way he possibly can, because he has a lot of reservations about it, so he's really trying to shore it up on every possible angle. And there are those who say that in some senses the Hatzimakira nowadays is better than it's ever been, because the person who's carrying it out is very, very careful about trying to eliminate as many shtekas as he possibly can, and only use it when it's really, in his eyes, justified. So he wrote a whole book about this, but he also had an article recently in Tchumen where he noted it's a little ironic that, you know, again, the original endorsers of the Heter wanted it to be temporary, and we made it so permanent that we're still using the contracts from 100 years ago, and the contracts have all kinds of concepts in them that people don't relate to Bechlau. And that further undermines the process, because the people don't have any idea what they're doing, they don't have any idea what they're signing, and therefore that's a bigger problem. So he, one of the things he did was he rewrote all the contracts. He made them much more user-friendly in a sense. He got rid of certain clauses that were there based on a chumrah of a suggestion of somebody 100 years ago. He got rid of all that, and he made them more accessible. Because that's part of the problem. He's very concerned about this issue of Gemiras Das. He's very concerned about whether the sale is done with full knowledge. Rav Kook also points out that even though the Gemara does say that if a sale is done not based on the premise, not based on the conventions of the society that they're living in, so even though the Gemara says that that's no good, but the Gemara also says that the two parties have the right to make a condition outside of that. So that's, again, it's the problem is its own solution. As far as Bina de Malchus Adina is concerned, that's a serious concern. Rav Herzog, who was one of the chief rabbis coming after Rav Kook and then overlapping the period of the founding of the state, so Rav Herzog thought this was a very serious issue, especially after the founding of the Medina, which certainly is a very significant milestone as far as this is concerned. So he writes that he's very concerned about this. Even though there were those who maintain, there are some who say that there's no concept of Dina Malchus Adina in Eretz Yisrael. That the whole concept of Dina Malchus Adina means that you're living in somebody's country, they have the right to tell you how to behave. But in Eretz Yisrael, it's the property of the Jewish people, so maybe no government has the right, no, certainly no outside government, a non-Jewish government has the right to tell you how to behave in Eretz Yisrael. Maybe. So that's, but now once there's a Jewish government in control, so then that radically changes things. And even if you want to say that maybe also a Jewish government doesn't have the right because we all own it together, so maybe Dina Malchus Adina doesn't apply to anyone in Eretz Yisrael, so there's certain things like regulating kinyan and regulating land ownership. He thinks that that's very questionable to say that Dina Malchus Adina couldn't regulate that. So he was very concerned about that. And in the 1970s, they actually passed a law in the Knesset. It's called something like the Chok Eshkos Karkon, something like that, Chok Lakim Hashmita, that they made a law that the government officially recognizes the sale of lands for Shemitah purposes. It doesn't have to be written in a taboo, the government officially recognizes this Mechira. So that may help for the Dina Malchus Adina problem. Rav Whiteman writes that he thinks that it doesn't help for the Gemiras Das problem. He thinks it makes it worse. Again, everything goes in both directions. Because here, now the government is officially telling you it's a joke. They're saying, yeah, we're not even going to bother with, we're not going to worry about whether it's done right or not, because we know that it's not serious, and we know that it's just a technicality, so therefore we'll be okay with it. So he says, if that's the case, so then that, maybe it helps for the Dina Malchus Adina part, so okay, it doesn't have a problem anymore on that level, but again, as far as the conventions are concerned, maybe it further undermines that. I mean, if everyone agrees together that that's maybe. That was his, he was not overly impressed with that. It could be. There's other quotes from the Chazon Ish, that the Chazon Ish, despite the fact that he was quite an opponent, but he thought that the Dina Malchus Adina part wasn't a problem. Because, it says, it's only a problem if the government prohibits it. But the government doesn't prohibit these sales, it just doesn't recognize it. So if you go to the town hall, you go look it up, so the government's not going to have any record, they're not going to record whether who owns this land. But they're not interfering, they're not telling you not to do it. So supposedly the Chazanish felt that that wasn't a Dina de Malchus Adina issue. It's hard to find that in the text. Zevin quotes that from the Chazanish. In the Chazanish itself, it's hard to find. There are other comments where he sounds like he's saying the opposite. So it's a little unclear whether or not that was really the Chazanish's view. Another one of the chief rabbis of Israel, Rav Gorin, also thought that the founding of the state created a major problem as far as the whole fundamental question of Kinyan L'Hazkiya, the whole question of whether selling property can change the Kedusha of Sa'aretz. But in his understanding, he's got a Tosfos in Kedushin that supports this point, that there's basically two levels of ownership. That there's individual, as far as Jewish ownership is concerned, there's the individual Jewish ownership, and then there is the fact that it's part of the Jewish land, it's Israel's ownership. So before there was a state, so then okay, so individual Jews owned the land, so then maybe they could sell it and be maskia kedushas haaretz. But here, if one Jew sells for somebody else, they're still all part of the incorporated state of Israel. So it was to say that that's now removed from Jewish ownership. He thought that that created a whole new level of problem. That not just that it's a Dina Malchus Adina problem, but just as far as the central question of whether the Kenyan actually changes the hands. It only changes the hands on the individual level, doesn't change the hands on a common level, so he had a problem. And he has a solution also. So that's he has an essay about this in his paper on Mode, and he has a lumbish way to get out of that problem, but he thought that was something that was a topic of concern as well. So that's part of the debate. So we're almost out of time, so maybe we'll make the dividing line here, and we'll just quickly find some of the points. So we have to pick up from, which I guess will be in 2 weeks, I guess, because I'm not here next week, unless you want to... So in two weeks from today. Okay, so I have a wedding next week, so then we'll pick up the following Tuesday. So what we have to still get to is the issue of whether it's mutter or not. It's a big, big question. Is it mutter to do this, even if you say it works 100%? Second of all, does the ability for it to work get affected by whether or not it's mutter? And then what are some other philosophical issues that may or may not come in? So just to quickly, if either... briefly, what we spoke about the fact that the whole controversy when it was put into place, the question of whether it's comparable to Mefer's Chametz or not. On the one hand, the rice of the Rabbanim seems to be in his favor. On the other hand, certain basic differences. You're not going to let somebody walk off with it. You're going to continue to be involved. You're using it to get around the din, and it has a plausibility factor. All those differences. On the other hand, maybe it's probably the Rabbanim for one of two reasons. Maybe even be only a Midas Chashibias and a Shashas Tzak, and all of that works together to help. Besides that, the concept of Ranuna, and also the possibility that maybe it's a suffix whether it's Shemitah or not, which again, basically we didn't like that at all. And then the question of some of the conditions that were put on, that it should only be a vote of the Rabbanim by a non-Jew, just to maintain what you have and should be reviewed. And then the question of how does it work? So it's Machlokes Megmar, whether there is Kinyan L'Hafkia or not. We're probably passing that there isn't, but that's only if it's the Rice, if it's the Rabbanim, then maybe there is. So it's Machlokes between Bais Yosef and the Mabit. A little bit of an open debate still for Lipaskin, like the Bais Yosef seems to say that Paris Sars don't have Kedusha. Whether he would extend that to the land also, and whether he would extend that to L'chashkila selling it, is still a topic of open question, which is why many who Paskin like the Bais Yosef don't go all the way to Hetzim Kira. And then the question also of, beyond the question of Kinyan L'Hafkia, the question of Smichas Das and Dina Malchus V'Dina, are people really doing this with full Das, and is it legal? What about the taboo? And then we mentioned the taboo issue in the 70s. The government recognized this, maybe they handled the Dina Malchus V'Dina issue, but not the issue of Gemaras Das. Maybe as the Weitman said, maybe it makes it worse. And then we mentioned two of the chief rabbis of Israel thought that the founding of Medina radically complicates the issue. Rav Herzog coming from the Dina Malchus Adina question, and Rav Gorin from Chiddush and the Kenyan problem, saying that there's also a communal ownership on top of individual ownership, and therefore even if an individual sells it, it's still part of Israel, which makes it hard to believe that it was Kedusha. And we mentioned he has a solution to that from a Lumbishah perspective. Okay, well, we'll continue. We'll pick up some of the other issues that come up in this discussion. Shkaiach. Yeah.